Since 1775,
generations of Americans
have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called.
And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide
at 1041kqth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. Let's start with a little bit of history, particularly today. I want to remind you that it was 20 years ago yesterday that a truck bomb carrying the equivalent lethality of 20 to 30,000 pounds of TNT was detonated outside the Khobar Towers housing complex in Al-Khobar, Saudi Arabia. At the time, the towers were being used to quarter coalition forces assigned to Operation Southern Watch, the mission to enforce a no-fly zone over southern Iraq. 19 U.S. servicemen of the United States Air Force 440th Wing were killed, and 498 persons of other nationalities and coalition partners were wounded. A three-year investigation by the FBI concluded that Iran was implicated in sponsoring the attack. In 2006, a U.S. court found Iran and Hezbollah guilty of orchestrating the attack. Osama bin Laden's fingerprints were also alleged to have been upon the attack. Now, that's going to be important later on here in the show because our guest spent a lot of his career in Saudi Arabia. But we're going to skip, we're going to put that out for a second, Russ. But our guest today is Major General Russ Violet. He is a member of the very select group called the Friday Pilots. We try and feature members of the Friday Pilots on a regular basis here on American Warrior Radio because they've got such great stories. They've got great service. Russ Violet, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Happy to be here.
Well, I tell you, it was hard to get you here.
Well, sometimes you have other things that you have to put on the back of the ledger in order to make time.
Fair enough. I appreciate that. Now, Russ, you, like I said, we've had the Friday Pilots on before. Your Air Force career spanned from you were Commissioner Second Lieutenant in 1958. You rose up to the rank of Major General, which for the civilians out there is two stars, correct, before you retired. But refresh our listeners' memories about the Friday Pilots. Tell us about that group.
Well, the Friday Pilots started here in Tucson by a couple of folks that are still part of that group in the 1980 time period up at a Abco grocery market. They'd go over there for 10 o'clock coffee on every Friday morning, and it started with about four or five guys, and then it grew, and over time it grew to 15 people, and we went to Rick's up mm-hmm. there at the River Center. We met every Friday. I joined the group in about 1990. It continued to grow. Today we have about 25 members. We meet now at the Hacienda del Sol every Friday and have lunch together. We lie to each other. We tell stories to each other. We support each other and take care of each other.
And some of those stories were compiled in a book called The Friday Pilots, a collection of stories. Each of you, or many of you, have a chapter in the book. And then just want to remind my listeners, you can buy that on Amazon.com. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of The Friday Pilots book go to benefit the Arizona Fisher House, which, if you're not aware of, is sort of parallel to Ronald McDonald House for military families receiving treatment, for the veterans receiving treatment here at the VA hospital in Tucson. Russ, let's start off. Each of you tell a story or a portion of your stories in the book. And I just want to start off because one of the things about your chapter that really fascinated me is the quantum leap that you've experienced in your lifetime in technology. You grew up on a homestead farm in Montana with a coal-burning stove, gas lanterns. You had to walk 100 feet to the outhouse in the Montana winter or use another alternative, and you've gone from that to flying jet aircraft and seeing the space shuttle. What I just think is important, particularly for our younger listeners out there to hear this, tell us about that homestead and your time growing up as a young man in Montana.
Well, at the time that it was going on, I was born in 1935. And so the Depression had just ended. My folks had just gotten married. They had moved onto the homestead that their father had started in 1907. They found two old shacks out in the countryside, and they drug those two shacks together and kind of nailed up a home with had a bedroom in one end and a kitchen in the other. But they also had lots of mice. My mother used to tell a story about holding the flashlight at night to spot the mice, and my dad would shoot them with a .22.
In the house?
In the house.
Okay.
It wasn't much of a house. It was mostly a shelter. Within about 10 years, that house changed into a real house. Growing up in that particular community, everybody was of the same background. And so having said that, I went to a one-room schoolhouse. My mother was a teacher through about the fourth grade. There were about 15 of us in that school.
Mm-hmm.
We'd come home at night, milk the cow, and for things to do, we played baseball in the family, or softball, or threw a ball over the roof and yelled anti-I over and throw it back. We didn't have electricity until I was in the sixth grade. And so you had to make your own time, make your own fun, and work it from that perspective.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories, or part of that story, Russ, is tell us about your third grade sweetheart.
Well, my wife and I went to the same schools, starting in about the third or fourth grade. We weren't sweethearts at the time, but we knew of each other.
Okay, all right. So you weren't dating in the third grade. I want to clarify that, yeah.
And from that point forward, occasionally we dated, and then we got in high school and we started to date a little bit more. They graduated from high school in 1954. I went to the University of Denver, and she went to the Western Montana College of Education. We didn't like being apart, so 19th of March in 1955, I gave her a ring and said, let's get married. So we did that in September 11th of 1955, and I went back down to Denver, and we finished school. Our first daughter was born a couple years later, graduated from college, commissioned, and into the Air Force we went, so that experience.
And still together to this day?
Still together, 61 years later.
Wow. Well, Dee, if you're listening, you caught a good one, Dee. Or I don't know who caught whom, but I'm guessing in Montana, maybe she caught you. Now, Russ, what else about, I want to get into amazing adventures as a pilot, you know, particularly in Vietnam. But from those times, now, how many children were there in the family of your siblings?
I had four daughters. The first one was born in 57, second in 59, the next one in 62, and the next one in 63.
I mean, of your siblings back on the farm?
Nobody else was in the military.
But well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is part of the reason what led you to join the Air Force was at some point, the farm at that time wasn't big enough to really break up, right, and be functional.
That was part of it. The other part of that was that my mother came from a large family. There was about six boys. Three of those boys had served in the military, and one of them had been associated with flying. One of my uncles had a light aircraft. He used to come over to the farm and say, Russ, let's go hunt coyotes. And so he would get in his Piper, and I'd get in the Piper. His only instruction to me was, don't shoot the wing.
Important safety tip.
So I kind of fell a little bit in love at that time, but that's not why I chose the Air Force. I was pitching hay from a haystack onto a sled with about 30 below zero temperatures and a 40-knot wind blowing, watching contrails in the sky, and I said, that has got to be a better way of life than experiencing this extremely cold conditions down here on the surface. So when I, again, remembering it was 1954, Korea had just ended. The draft was still on. I'd been registered for the draft. To maintain a deferment in college, I had to maintain that deferment by being, among other things, in a ROTC program at college. So I did that, and I selected the Air Force, primarily because of those contrails, if you will. And so that worked out very well for me.
Well, little did you know, maybe at that time, Russ, that you'd go from the frozen plains of Montana to a very, very different hot and steamy jungle in the jungles of Vietnam. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined today by Major General Russ Violet. When we come back, we're going to talk about something he calls in his chapter, 6 Hours of Hell. We'll be right back. Stick around.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We're very pleased to be joined live in studio by Major General, United States Air Force retired Russ Violet. Russ is one of the Friday Pilots, has a chapter in the Friday Pilots book. And Russ, I tell you, well, I'll just get right into it. One of the segments that you wrote on the book, just I read it 4 or 5 times, so it just had me fascinated, is not the right word, maybe scared a little bit is the right word. But you write about a particular mission when you were flying F-105s in Vietnam that just, I mean, you literally, you called it 6 Hours of Hell. Before we talk about that mission, though, let's talk a little bit about the F-105. That is a very special aircraft, isn't it?
It's my favorite airplane. Let me go back to the beginning a little bit. Coming out of pilot training, I went to F-100s, and I flew the F-100 for 3 years at Misawa, Japan. Came out of there in the 1963 time period and went to McConnell Air Force Base, where I checked out in the F-105. That was in the spring of 64. In the spring of, let me back up, the 105, when I checked out in it, the first time I walked up to that big airplane, it was 65 feet long, it was about 19 feet high at the top of the tail. When you climbed up the ladder to get in the cockpit, you were sitting at 14 feet above the ground.
Wow.
When you walked under the wings of the airplane, the wheel assemblies were 8 feet off the ground. So it was a big airplane. It had a bomb bay in it. It was built as a nuclear bomb carrier for tactical type strikes. It had a very high speed capabilities, 850 knots on the deck. It had Mach 2 capability at altitude. It had a big engine. It burned fuel, lots of fuel. When we, having checked out in it, I loved the airplane. It could carry with essentially in max load conditions, you could get up to 16 750-pound bombs on board.
Now, that, just to give folks a perspective, that is greater than what a B-17 carried during World War II, isn't it, or right
it's
about there?
It's about the same as far as the total weight of the bomb load. 10 to 12,000 pounds would be typical for the B-17, I think.
Now, the F-105, as I understand it, it was one of, I don't know if it's one of the few aircraft, but literally, that's a plane that started with a bang. Was there an odd or a weird way the engine was fired up?
The engine starter was based on a canister, an explosive canister. And when you triggered the canister, the burning of the fuel in that canister created turned a turbine at a higher rate of speed, and the turbine itself turned the starting element of the engine. So you had a lot of black smoke and noise, and that would get the engine RPM up to approximately 15%, at which time the fuel and the ignition of the regular sequence would bring you on up to idle, which was around 70%.
Okay. Now, you were training, flying the F-105, and you, in your book you talk about you'd very often have drills, and you guys would scramble, but there was a certain point, April 1965, the siren sounded, you said, for real. You told your wife, Dee, to pack a real bag, and you were off to Asia.
We were off to somewhere in Asia. They wouldn't tell us where we were going or when we were going to go. So we were on alert to do that. 3 days later, they launched us. We had 18 aircraft in the element that was going, 2 8-ship elements and a 4-ship element, including the spares. We joined up with tankers over the West Coast. We flew to Hickam, Hawaii, 4,000 miles and a 9-hour profile. So we relaxed a little bit that evening at the Hickam Air Force Base Officers Club.
How on earth did you do that?
Well, we had some Mai Tais at the bar.
Some
Mai Tais. The reason he said some was that a couple of the guys decided to have a contest of how many Mai Tais would be appropriate for this particular group. I dropped out after two, but there were a couple guys on board that finished first and second with 14 and 13 Mai Tais apiece.
And please tell me you didn't have to fly again the next day.
We got up the next morning and we flew to Guam.
Oh boy, I'd hate to be the guy. Well, it's a single pilot aircraft, so yes. He was on his own, right?
Well, the scenario was that when we landed at Hickam, the folks that were in charge of our group, the commander and a couple others, gave everybody a very bad time about being mouthy on the radio during that particular crossing. So everybody kept their mouths shut. Nobody said anything until we got to Guam. We're landing there at Anderson. And the first time anybody said anything was number two, and one of the elements said, "Lead, I need a straight in." And he said, "No, you have to land from a pitch out, overhead pitch out." And he said, "I've got to land straight in, sir. I've got to put my gear down using the manual system." "Why?" "Well, I lost my utility hydraulics about 4 hours ago, and so I need to be able to get them down in a straight and level condition." So anyway, that was the only words that were spoken on that particular segment.
Now, your eventual destination was Thailand, and as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, General, but your group was only in Thailand a couple of days before you were given your very first real live mission.
We landed one day. We spent the next day at briefing, 2 days worth. The morning of the third morning after we were there, we flew our first mission. The elements of war were there. You know, we learned very rapidly that, you know, they were very dangerous, because on the fourth day we lost our first guy in combat. I lost the airplane and him in a southern North Vietnam position.
Okay, so let me ask you this if I can. We've got about 2 minutes before the first break. And I've had a lot of guests on, but getting a first hand from you, you train. But at some point, the bombs are real, the enemy is real. What kind of thoughts go through your mind at that?
Well, that's a very good question, because you've been used to rolling in on a controlled range. Mm-hmm. Now you've got bombs on board. They're hot. They're armed. You've greened them up to drop them on something. We were bombing bridges. We were bombing railroad tracks. We were bombing storage sites. We were making road cuts. And when we rolled in on this particular first target, which was a storage site, it didn't look like a storage site. It looked like red clay brick roofs, white buildings, all lined up very, very pretty. This can't be the right target. But it was. We bombed it. The secondary explosions that came out of it proved it to us that it was a storage site. So it was hard to grasp that in that short condition.
Okay, now the mission, what you call 6 hours of hell, give us a little bit of background on that, because it's interesting you mentioned you guys are sitting there and you're watching the North Vietnamese build these SAM sites, but you weren't allowed to attack them for a little while. These were no-fly zones, correct?
The rules of engagement that came out of the Pentagon and the National Command Authorities, we could not attack those sites. They had to be firing back at us, firing at us before we could strike them. None of them had fired at us. So 2 days before the mission we're going to talk about happened, they shot down two or three aircraft, I guess it was, F-4s, shot one out of the sky, and two landed very damaged. And 2 days later, we had a frag order to go attack those particular sites in North Vietnam.
And 24 aircraft took off on that mission?
24 aircraft from Thak Le, after one site, and 24 aircraft from Karat, another air base with 105s, went after the second site.
Ladies and gentlemen, six of those aircraft did not return from that mission. Our guest is Major General Russ Violet. We're live in studio. Give us a call. Great guest. Open to your questions. 751-1041. There's your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. We're going to talk about 6 hours of hell when we come right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live in studio by Major General Russ Violet. Among the many things that Russ did in his career, he flew F-105s in Vietnam, and we're going to talk specifically about a mission that took place on July 27, 1965. In his own words in the Friday Pilot's book, Russ called it 6 hours of hell. Now, Russ, we kind of introduced folks to the mission here. Before this time, the SAM sites, the North Vietnamese surface-to-air missile sites, were off-limits. It was a no-fly zone, but after they blew three F-4s out of the sky, it was time to take care of that problem.
Right.
Now, again, and this is fascinating for me as a civilian. People need to understand this. You were flying, you were armed with napalm and cluster bombs.
In my case, the flight we were in had cluster bomb units, which was about 600 or 700 grenade-type weapons that came out of a canister. The wings came out, it braked itself, and when it hit the ground, it blew up.
Now, the thing about cluster bombs is you have to be directly over the target. There's no glide path on these bombs like today's bombs.
Right.
I mean, you've got to fly right over the guy shooting at you when you
right.
drop it, right?
So we were flying at 100 feet and about 560 knots over the target when we dropped the weapon.
Now, folks, so you understand, 100 feet, the Tucson City Hall is 120 feet tall. So they were flying lower than that, dropping bombs with people shooting at them. And Trent, I'm from the desert, so knots is about how many miles per hour?
One knot is equal to maybe 7 miles an hour, 8 miles an hour.
So you're going fast.
Going very
fast and low, which is what the plane was designed for.
Right.
Okay, now the mission did not get off to a very good start. As I understand it, before you even took off, one of the aircraft, his weapons
yes.
and his ordnance and his tanks just kind of plunked off right there on the tarmac.
We were lined up. 24 aircraft were lined up. We're in the arming area, and the ground handlers that were arming the pylons so that they were hot, so they'd work when you wanted to release them normally or eject them. When they installed the plugs to enable that particular pylon, it jettisoned all the ordnance and fuel tanks that he had on the airplane. He was sitting right beside me. The fuel started running around on the ramp underneath it. In the meantime, the pilot of that airplane had shut it down. He was crawling out over the top of the nose. We taxied away from it and got away from it. And nothing happened, luckily. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any fires there, but it was rather scary at that time. He was number three in the flight, and I was number four in the lead flight. They moved me into the number three position, and they assigned a spare to our unit that joined up after the tanker en route to the target.
Now, luckily, that fellow that was flying as a spare had extensive combat experience, right?
He had none.
Oh, okay.
He had delivered an aircraft from Yokota, Japan, that as a replacement aircraft to the unit, and he wanted to fly a combat mission, so they said, okay, you can fly spares. So when he joined the flight as a spare, I told Lead I needed to talk to him, so I sent him over to a manual channel, and I said, you need to do three things for me on this flight. The first one is that never fly below my altitude, because I knew I was going to be really low, and I didn't want him below it because I'd drag him off on something.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing was I didn't want him anywhere other than on my left side. So if he stayed on my left side, I knew exactly where he was at, and I wouldn't have to worry about him. Third thing was I didn't want him lagging behind me, so I told him I wanted to see his pedostatic boom, which was on the nose of the airplane, through my peripheral vision on my left side at all times. And I said, that's all I got for you. Just hey, stay there.
So you guys are pretty tight.
Pretty tight.
Now, you rolled in there, and you dropped your ordnance on target. Now, I guess when you're coming in, the lead element had already bombed the target, so you could see the dust or the smoke coming up.
We were the lead element.
Okay.
We were a flight of four, and the flight of two and we'd broken into was about 15 seconds in front of me as we were approaching the target. Yes, you could see the dust from his ordnance on that target, but you could also see a lot of 37 millimeter, 57 millimeter, 85 millimeter flak that was over the target for the for about the last 50 miles as we were moving into the target. We hit the target, moved off to a southwesterly heading. Our number two man in that flight had been hit. He had ejected. The flight leader, squadron commander, was circling 3,000 or 4,000 feet above the ground to keep track of him. I yelled at Jack to get his aircraft down because I was sure that a surface-to-air missile was going to take him out of the sky. Well, that didn't happen, but my good friend Walt Costco, who had jumped out, was now parachuting, and it was above a river, the Black River, west of Hanoi. And as we watched him go down, he wasn't moving, so I was pretty sure he was already dead. But he went into the river and never came back up, and they never did find him.
Now, there was also another group where you talk about the one of the aircraft was leaking fluids, and you were concerned about getting him over the river, and that his wingman went to check on him, and things went wrong, and those two aircraft collided, and you lost both those pilots.
Both those pilots. He got too close. He lost the aircraft, lost control. They crashed together. Neither one survived the ejection that occurred after that.
Now, and your egress plan took you very close to the second SAM site, so this was getting pretty sporty.
Let me amplify that a little bit. We were aware that Karat was attacking the target, which was 1.7 miles away from the one that we had. But what we didn't realize is that the headquarters had assigned the same TOT time to both units.
TOT is?
Time on target.
Okay.
For both units from Takli and Karat. And Karat was attacking from the southwest and egressing northwest. We were attacking from the northwest and egressing southwest. So we had 24 aircraft coming at each other at 500 knots, driving through each other at the target.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were lucky we didn't run into each other, but we had several narrow misses, if you will, which was, to say the very least, exciting.
good point. Yeah. Now, it's always a bad day when the guy shooting at you, well, you know you're low when the fellows shooting at you have got their gun barrels depressed about as far as they can go. And on your way back out again, you decided to, what, harvest some bananas or what?
Well, I was meeting one of those flights that was head-on and at us, and it didn't look like, you know, it was going to have much space, so I pushed the nose down in order to go under them, and we were already at 100 feet. And so as we went just underneath that flight going by, I picked off a few banana leaves in the recovery phase coming up out of that as they went by. So, yeah, it was close.
Now, banana trees, as I recall, aren't that tall.
No, that's right, 20, 30 feet.
Oh, my gosh. So did you get some kind of award for, well, your crew chief probably wasn't real happy with you, right?
Well, it wasn't that much. There was no damage to the airplane, per se. Let me say this, though, about that particular egress, because you brought up the fact that we were being attacked by 85-millimeter guns. That resulted in us driving across the berms of those placements, and when that gun would fire, you could see the fireball come out of the barrel of the gun, then you'd see the big smoke donut, and about that time you'd go by them and you'd get the explosion of the bomb, of the gun being fired in the cockpit. It was very, very loud and obviously very scary.
Now, when you finally got back to your base, you and your wingman both returned in good shape, minus a few bananas sticking out of your tail there. But in your book you had a quote when you finally landed and you went over to talk to him. He asked you one question. Do you remember what in the book what he asked you?
He said, "My God, are they all like this?" And I said, "No, thank God they aren't."
Yeah. Wow. And I, Russ, thank you so much for that, because it's such a compelling story. Now, you earned both the Legion of Merit and the Distinguished Flying Cross. Were either of those awarded for this mission, or were those?
The Distinguished Flying Cross was for that mission. And that was the 27 July mission. Legion of Merit was for other times later in life, and other things were also later in my career.
Well, we need a second show to talk about this. We'd love to have you back. Folks, just want to remind you, we do have General Violet live in studio. If you want to ask him a question, feel free to give us a call, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back in a little bit. And Russ, when we come back, the time flies when I've got a great guest. We've got a lot to cover. But when we come back, I want to play a little word association for you. I'm going to read a phrase here, and then when we come back, I want you to tell me what you hear. So, word association. Roger Maple Leaf, be advised that your number two man has fire coming out of the left side of his fuselage. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live in studio by Major General Russ Violet, a very interesting adventure as a pilot. And I always found, Russ, that it's a good idea, a good career move to poke a general with a sharp stick before we go to the commercials. So I'd read a word association for you. Just a reminder in your book that the dangers faced by the men and women in our military aren't always when people are shooting at you. So when I read that phrase to you, tell us about what that relates to.
Well, that was, I was flying a mission at Nellis Air Force Base, training to learn how to shoot at an aerial target. I had flown a mission in the morning. Everything had gone well. I had duty officer desk assignment that afternoon. The same flight leader that I had in the morning came out of a flight briefing. One of the four individuals was sick. And so he said, Russ, you're going to fly in his position. You're going to go out and we're going to attack an aerial target again. So I said, okay, and I went out and jumped in the airplane and took off on his wing. And as I was taking off and rolling down the runway, Nellis Tower said, Maple Lead, this is Tower. And he said, stand by. We got our gear and flaps and everything up. He said, Tower, go ahead. And the tower responded with, Maple, be advised your number two man has orange flame coming out of the left side of your fuselage. I dawned on me they were talking about me. I looked in the cockpit. I had everything was normal except for two lights. That was an overheat and a fire light. And
that's a bad day when the fire light comes on.
That's a bad day. So I started to separate it out, and the flight lead said to spread it out. I was spreading it out to the left. The aircraft became non-responsive and rolled with the ailerons. Started to roll into him. I had to use the left rudder to lift the nose back up and get it off. We were about 200 feet in the air at the time. As we got a little more altitude, then I started to lose control of the aircraft. I reached down, I pulled the ejection levers, and I was on the ground.
Now, well, that's a Reader's Digest version, but I mean, basically you're trying to gain altitude because you've got to be at a certain height. I don't know what the minimum height for ejection is, but it's definitely above 200 feet, I'm guessing.
In 1960, when this happened, at 18 November 1960, 1:43 in the afternoon, the minimum ejection altitude recommended by the book was 2,000 feet.
Oh, boy.
So this was an all-manual system. It was a 37-millimeter shell that you fired. You were attached to the seat with your parachute, and when you made seat separation, it pulled the D-ring and pulled your chute for you. That was the hardest thing I had to do in my life at that point, was hanging on to something for dear life, and now I have to throw it away.
Well,
and when I threw it away, well, the chute came up. And interestingly enough, you mentioned Hoot Gibson earlier in this hard conversations. Hoot was a supervisor of flying on the ramp at that time, and he told me many years later that he said, I didn't think your chute was going to open, Russ, but it did. And I said, yeah, I'm here.
Now, so people understand, I mean, you're in an aircraft that's on fire. There's a fuse burning, but all at the same time, you're trying to get as much altitude as possible so you can get out of that.
That's survival.
Yeah. So you punch out.
your helmet shifts 90 degrees. You can't see what's going on initially. You swing a couple of times, then bang, you're on the ground.
And the interesting part of that was that after I was on the ground, it was a 25-knot wind blowing, and I was being dragged across the surface, and then being a farm boy, I reached up and tried to disconnect the quick disconnect on the parachute harness, but I was a little bit befuddled at the time and didn't take the cover off, so I was squeezing the cover. So recognizing that wasn't working, I pulled the straps in, got the parachute collapsed, looked around. My knees were shaking a little bit. I sat down on the ground. I leaned back, laid back, back of my head, hit a shale rock, cut my back of my head open. I had blood all over my shoulder when the helicopter crew got there. They asked if I was okay, and I said, I'm right. I'm very good. Take me to the squadron. And they said, no, you're going to the hospital.
You're bleeding from hitting your head on a rock. I'd say, well, yeah, God bless Hoot Gibson. That's a little irony there. We've got a caller, John. John, you've called American Warrior Radio to talk to Major General Violet. What is your question or comment for us?
Yes, sir. You know, I was wondering how World War II changed, from the capital ship to the battle or to the carrier. Does he see droids and like the XB-47B or something like that? How does he see that pilots will eventually be less and less exposed to combat?
Now that's
in the near future.
Thanks, John. Thanks for your call and thanks for listening to American War. You know, Russ, that raised a good question. I've never flown, but I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy. I believe there always should be a pilot in an aircraft, but doesn't look like we're headed that way.
Well, the pilotless aircraft have been in the system for many, many years. And if you go back about 20 years in the Pentagon, they were planning on having by the 2010-15-20 time period, the total tactical forces were going to be without pilots. The pilots managed to succeed in saying we got to have air crews on board to make decisions that are the result of the situations that they are becoming aware of in the condition that they're in. So I'm strongly opposed to doing away with pilots. I strongly support their involvement in the aircraft. It's more expensive to keep a pilot in the airplane because you got to build the environment for him to survive in. And you don't have to do that in a drone. But I'm all for pilots continuing to fly.
Okay, great. I hope that answers your question, John. Russ, I couldn't agree more. Just coming back to your conversation about that mission in Vietnam, this might be kind of a leap, but if those had been groups of drones going at each other, I don't know that it would have turned out. Now, we wouldn't have lost human life, but still, okay. Well, I introduced this show talking about the anniversary of the Khobar Towers bombing. You spent a great amount of your career. In fact, the end of your Air Force career was in Saudi Arabia, and then you returned there to do some consulting for many years after that. What are your thoughts? We don't have enough time. You tell me a great story about, or you tell a great story about when you were in Saudi Arabia and you describe it as showing up to the Tales of Arabian Nights in an Air Force uniform. But what, having spent a lot of time there, what would you like to share with us about the hospitality of those folks? Seem to be outstanding.
That's part of their culture, is to take care of their hosts. They did that well. After your 15th goat grab, you don't want to see more rice. I found the personalities involved both at the squadron levels, the national level, the Minister of Defense arena, to be very, very friendly and very hospitable.
Now you describe, and I can't remember the holiday.
The Ramadan, the Feast El-Fitr, was the celebration of the Ramadan ending. And so they had a recognition period during that party where all the VIPs in the area visited with each other throughout the community. And at each one, they had sit-down meals. And so by the time he got through meeting everybody and eating and eating and eating, they also shared their incense and their burners. You'd come around and put the smoke in your face, and it was considered rude not to let the smoke come into you, so you fan the smoke into your face. One thing led to another, and by the time I got home, I got close to the door. My wife said, take that coat off and leave it outside before you come in the house. So.
Yeah, well, and yeah, you know, kind of the visual image I got when you talked about that is in the Native American tradition with the smudge, where you kind of you sort of drape it over your head. That's a tradition. Probably your favorite tradition, though, you describe is with the coffee. 10 cups, 350 guests.
Right. So you're sitting around the edge of the great big building, great big room. And before I walked in there, I was considered the governor's guest. And so they led me across the middle of that room, which would be like if you were in a gymnasium, you'd go from the far corner to the far corner. And that's when I tried to describe the fact that you felt like you were part of that old core, that old system.
Uh-huh.
I'm in my Class A's. They're in their thobes and gutras and scimitars. Everything is there. But anyway, that was an experience that was unforgettable.
Well, Russ, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us here on American Warrior. Folks, again, the book is called The Friday Pilots. You can get it on Amazon. Our guest has been Major General Russ Violet, just an outstanding gentleman. We're so pleased to have you still here in Tucson, all the way from the wilds of Montana.
It's my pleasure to be here. We love it.
Okay. Folks, don't forget, share the message. You can visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. This broadcast and past podcasts there, you can download them. Like us on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail. Follow us on Twitter at Warrior Radio Tucson. Podcasts can be found on iTunes via your mobile device at Stitcher.com and on the Roku streaming player via the Nowhere Cast. Thanks again, Russ, for being on American Warrior. Folks, go out and support our advertisers. Really appreciate it. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.